Okay, so we're going to just finish up chapter 6 real quick, move on into chapter 7. But as we review, again, we know Paul is defending himself from these false charges that these false brethren, these false apostles are making, who are currently influencing the Corinthians. And here's the shocker, the Corinthians are buying into all this. And so Paul's relationship with them is very estranged. And so Paul is trying to connect with them. And the last thing that we were talking about is that Paul was inviting them to come and be part of this ministry of reconciliation. But he said you need to get yourself right first. And there's some things that are going on in your life that if you don't fix them, you will not be able to be part of the ministry. And not only that, if you were part of the ministry, it's going to cause problems and offenses that will bar or disturb the success, affect the success of the ministry. And so one of the things that Paul talks about is don't become unequally yoked with unbelievers. And on Sunday morning, we compared that with what he wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where he says, no, you have to be among the unbelievers so that you can be an influence to them. And so we talk about that balance between living in the world but not being of the world. Being like Jesus and Paul, where we become all things to all men, but that we do not practice their immorality and their sin. And so Paul talks about being unequally yoked, and we said that there's a few places in the first chapter or the first book where this appears to be still going on, perhaps to some degree. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9 through 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 9 through 12. And this is the one I wanted to finish off on. So hold your place in 1 Corinthians 6, or 2 Corinthians 6, and go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. All right, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and we're going to read 20 through 23. Remember, this is in that context of eating meat sacrificed to idols. We said that there are basically three questions that they were asking. And one of them was, can we still be involved in these idolatrous banquets? And this is kind of in Paul's response. He says in verse 20, no, but I say that the things with the Gentile sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers in demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. Or do we provoke the Lord to jealousy? We are not stronger than he, are we? All things are lawful, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful, but not all things edify. And so you remember that Paul, in verse 23, all things are lawful. That's a very, almost the exact same thing he says in the previous chapter, chapter 6, the second one, verse 12. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are profitable. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be mastered by anything. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, Paul's answer is no, you can't go and partake of the Lord's Supper and worship Jesus Christ and then go be partakers with those who are worshiping and offering to demons, to idols. And so it's almost the exact same thing that he says here at the end of 2 Corinthians chapter 6, where he says, verse 17, "Therefore come out from their midst and be separate, says the Lord, and do not touch what is unclean." So if you're willing to do that, Corinthians, and that's what has to be done if you're going to reconcile with God, and furthermore, if you're going to be part of this ministry, but look at what he says. If you're willing to do this, to separate and not touch what is unclean, then here's what God's going to do. "And I will welcome you, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty." So as we get to chapter 7, I believe that we have a few things here, but I believe that what we have some insight here is one of the things that these false teachers were really using to fuel the fire to turn the Corinthians against Paul. And so we're going to see, what is it that they were using against Paul? Okay? So let's go ahead and take a look at chapter 7. And let's go chapter 7, verses 1 through 7 to start with. He says, "Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Make room for us in your hearts. We wronged no one. We corrupted no one. We took advantage of no one. I do not speak to condemn you, for I have said before that you are in our hearts, to die together and to live together. Great is my confidence in you. Great is my boasting on your behalf. I am filled with comfort. I am overflowing with joy in all our affliction. For even when we came into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, for we are afflicted on every side, conflicts without and fears within. But God, who comforts the depressed, comforted us by the coming of Titus, and not only by his coming, but also by the comfort with which he was comforted in you, as he reported to us your longing, your mourning, your zeal for me, so that I rejoiced even more." Okay, so let's go and kind of take this, as we've been doing, verse by verse. Now you kind of get the flow of the beginning of this chapter. So let's go to verse 1. And you can see I have up here a title, that this is not just an invitation to be reconciled, to be part of this ministry, but what we'll see here is really an urging. And we've already kind of seen that in chapter 6, where Paul urged them, open your hearts to us, just as we have what? Opened our hearts to you. So, in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1, there's one of those, therefore. It keeps building on all of these things. Therefore, I've said all this, therefore, to say this. Having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Anything stand out to you there? You get the gist of what he's saying? Okay. If anything stands out, let me know. Okay. One thing I want to point out is he says, therefore, having these promises. What promises is Paul referring to? Yes. Good. Excellent. So, obviously he's not bringing up some obscure thing. These are the things he's mentioned at the end of chapter 6. Let's go back and tell me, what are some of these promises you think he's talking about? Yes, good. Verse 18. I will be a father to you, and you will be sons and daughters to me. That's a wonderful promise that we still have advantage of today. What else do we see? Yes. I will receive you. I will welcome you. Anything else you see in those verses? David? What's that? Yeah, we will be his people. And then notice verse 16. Another promise. We are the temple living God, so what does God do? I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and as Sue just said, and they shall be my people. Now, we already talked about that all those promises are going to come, but first they have to what? They have to come out from among these unbelievers. They have to stop being unequally yoked. Do you see anything like that here in chapter 7, verse 1? Almost like a summary statement of everything he said? Excellent. Yeah. He's calling on them, or as I say up there, he's urging them. Make these promises not in vain, but make them come alive for you. But what do they have to do according to verse 1? Exactly. Almost like he's just summarizing everything he said. You've got the promises, chapter 6, we just looked at. And what? Being unequally yoked. So this way he puts it, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit. So that's part of it, right? You become reconciled to Christ. I talked about there's a lot of Bible basics here, Christian basics. We come to Christ, we're new Christians. And what? Well, part of being a new Christian and continuing on in our Christianity is what? Continuing to be cleansed of the world. Being clean, not touching the unclean parts of the world. Putting, as other passages say, the old man of self off. But is that it? Just to stay away from sin. Because we fear God, which is in there. Exactly right. But there's a second component. Perfecting holiness in the fear of God. So there is the remaining cleansed from the uncleanness of the world. But then there's also the perfecting of holiness. And as Sue just said, why do we do that? What's the motivate? The fear of God. That fear of God. Go ahead, David.
Faith and works working together.
You do.
By works is their faith made perfect.
Exactly. A great example of that. Good point. Anyone else see anything in there? All right, good. Good comments. All right, so not only to cleanse ourselves from the defilements of flesh and spirit, but we also need to perfect holiness, become complete in that holiness, in the fear of God. All right. So you can't be complete in holiness without being cleansed of all defilements. That's so important. There's just so many religious people. I mean, they're faithful to their church. They attend regularly, but they don't do so good on being cleansed from the defilements of the world. They talk like the world. In a lot of cases, they act like the world. It's like, what kind of preaching are you getting? Who's telling you these things are okay as a Christian? Is that what Christ did? No. They would not in a million years say, yeah, Christ did that. Christ used some foul language. Christ used God's name in vain. No. But they're not getting the teaching they need. They're not being told that you can't be complete in holiness without being cleansed from all the defilements of the world. All right. Verse 2. Whoops. Make room for us in your hearts. We wronged no one. We corrupted no one. We took advantage of no one. So what's Paul doing here? What's going on here? Some more accusations, right? Again, with 2 Corinthians, a lot of times you just, when Paul says, I didn't do this, you flip it as, that must be what they're accusing him of. So what are they accusing him of? Wronging people? Corrupting people? And taking advantage of people. Okay? So here we have another one where Paul is defending himself. But notice the first part of this. Make room for us in your hearts. Have we heard that statement before? Yeah. Let's go back. Chapter 6, verse 11. This is kind of like what we call bookends, right? Just ties things together. Chapter 6, verse 11. Our mouth has spoken freely to you, O Corinthians. Our heart is open wide to you. Then in verse 13, he says it again. Now in like exchange, I speak as children, what? Open wide to us. And then he comes back to it, and he says, one of the ways you know that we're close is that we've opened our hearts to you again. He's urging them not just to open their hearts, but what's he say? Make room, right? A lot of people don't open their house to others because they don't think they have enough room, right? Where am I going to put these people? You know, and that's one of the things that we've done a disservice to ourselves as a society. I understand, you know, older people, they need a place to sit and be comfortable. But I continue to look at these churches overseas in Eastern Europe and Africa, and they're in this small room, and some are sitting, and if there's not enough seats, guess where the others are? They're on the floor. They're on the floor. And they're not upset. And I kind of feel like there's a lot of Americans that would be just like, well, I'm not going. I got to sit on the floor. And so I got off on a tangent there. But he's make room for us. Well, sometimes we think, well, we just don't have enough room. Well, we probably do. But we're just too embarrassed to have people sit in a small chair or sit in the corner or even sit on the floor. So he says, not only open your hearts, but make room for us in your hearts. That takes it a step further. And then you have, again, possible charges. Wrong, corrupted, and took advantage. And of course, Paul's saying, I didn't do these things. And so what you have is a possibility where if you spin these around, what? Three reasons why they should open their hearts and make room for Paul. Because he didn't wrong anyone. He didn't corrupt anyone. He didn't take advantage of anyone. And so a little more of the defense, a little more of the urging, which brings us to verse 3 and 4. He says, I do not speak to condemn you, for I have said before that you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. Great is my confidence in you. Great is my boasting on your behalf. I am filled with comfort. I am overflowing with joy in all our affliction. All right, take a look at those. We're building here. What's Paul doing? What's going on here? Well, first off, I do not speak to condemn you. I think that's one of the things that is probably the charge against Paul, probably what these teachers were able to really get these Corinthians to turn against Paul. Because especially in that first letter, 1 Corinthians, what do we always say? Oh man, it's one problem after another problem after another problem. And you could just see the Corinthians reading this letter. And you could read it, you know, especially if you've got the devil over your shoulder. Like, who does the guy think he is? He's not happy with anything. He's always condemning you. Who's he to judge you? It's a good thing we don't have people doing that today in our society, right? Christians are loving people. They don't judge people. They don't point out what's wrong. That's not the way Christians are today. Well, biblical Christians still make judgments, but out of love, right? So Paul says, I don't condemn you. I'm not trying to condemn you. And then probably this verse. These are probably some of the most intimate, most loving words, most encouraging words that we have seen so far, right? Look at what he says. I'm not speaking to condemn you, for I have said before, I'm not saying anything new, but I said it before, you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. How does that work? I thought death and life were opposite. So how are they going to die together and how are they going to live together? Okay. Meaning, kind of just build on that.
They're both Christians. They're both followers of God. They die to their own life.
Yeah.
Live together in newness of life.
Yeah. At least they're supposed to. Yeah.
You know,
good.
These people are maybe saying the same thing, but think about it. Hmm. About what, you know, we live together.
Yeah. Think of what we've been through.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good. Go ahead, David.
I don't think he's referring to physical death.
Yeah. Great point. Yeah, back to verse 1. Tie it in to that cleansing ourselves from the defilements of the flesh and even the defilements of the spirit. That would be an interesting little study. What's the defilements of the spirit? We figure out the flesh, but what about the spirit? Maybe look at that a little bit more later on. But yeah, you don't have to be in Christ to die together. Everyone's going to be dying, right? But yeah, I think Mike and David got it. The death that we die together is that death to sin, right? And when we die to sin, we die to sin because we have been resurrected to the newness of life. And that's what he means, I believe, when he says, you are in our hearts to live together. And so in a very poetic, loving way, you have one of these passages where the old man dies and the new man is resurrected to life. Okay? And he says, great is my confidence in you. Great is my boasting on your behalf. I am filled with comfort. I am overflowing with joy. Paul says, I'm not upset at you. I'm not writing these things to condemn you. In fact, it's the opposite. I am filled with confidence and joy. We are dying together and we're going to live together. You know? Couldn't you see a romantic husband who's kind of done the wrong thing to his wife? And his wife's, are you always upset with me? No, honey. I'm filled with love for you. I'm ready to die for you and live with you at the same time. Beautiful words that Paul says. So I don't speak to condemn you, but notice this. I am overflowing with joy. Did you pick up on this? He's got joy for them. But what's he going through? Affliction. There's that paradox of the Bible. Paradox of Christianity. Things can be going terribly, terribly wrong in the world, and Christians have joy. Over and over and over. But in order to have that joy, you've got to have that Christian perspective. You've got to have God in your heart. You've got to have that faith of confidence that, yeah, it looks like it's going all wrong, but I know God's there. I'm just going to put it on God. And the more you're able to do that, you're going to be amazed at how easy your life is when you take all the burden and all the stress and all the worry and all the anxiety and just, God, just deal with that. I'm going to let you deal with that in your time, in your way, and I'm just going to keep praying about it and praying what I'm hoping will happen. But it's not easy, is it? We like to stress out and be filled with anxiety and so forth. So maybe something we work on this week. You know, just give it over to God. God will take care of it. It's okay. I just got to do the right thing. I just got to pray about it. So I saw that and I thought, well, you've got kind of a neat little thing where he's overflowing with joy in all affliction. Anything else on that, on those two verses? All right. So Paul says, I'm receiving you. I'm accepting you. Let's just kind of highlight some of these words. Chapter 6, verse 11, how do we know that? He says, he opened his heart wide to them. Chapter 7, verse 3, the Corinthians were in his heart, he says. You are in my heart. Maybe kind of like he said in verse 2, I've made room for you. You're in my heart. Chapter 7, verse 4, Paul had great confidence in them. Again, verse 4, Paul boasted on their behalf. You will learn in chapter 9 and in verse 1 and 2, one of the times that Paul boasted about the Corinthians, it had to do with the contribution for the needy saints. So, all of a sudden, Paul seems to have this very positive view of them. He seems to be very encouraged, as if something has happened. He's gained some new knowledge about the Corinthians have really just made him confident about them. So let me ask you this question. As you look at chapter 7, and I'll just give you a hint, we haven't quite read this. Oh, actually, we did read it at the beginning. What has given Paul such confidence to have such a positive view of them, according to what's written here in chapter 7? Do you see it? Thank you. Absolutely. Who did he finally run into? Titus. What did Titus do? He gave him a report. Apparently, where had Titus been? Corinth, yes. And so he's very positive, he's very encouraged, because Titus has brought back a good report. So let's talk a little bit about Titus's report. Let's go back to chapter 7 and in verse 5. Because you have kind of a book in here. He talks about the Titus report in verses 5 and 7. Then he kind of, I don't know if I want to say breaks away, because I think it's related. But he talks about something else. And then he comes back to Titus at the very end. All right? So let's look at verse 5, 6, and 7, chapter 7. So he says, "For even when we came into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were afflicted on every side, conflicts without, fears within. But God who comforts the depressed," notice that word, "God who comforts the depressed." Did Paul ever become down, depressed? Yeah, he did. Just like you and I do. But what? He didn't stay in that. He was able to what? Lift himself up. "But God who comforts the depressed comforted us by the coming of Titus. And not only by his coming, but also by the comfort with which he was comforted in you, as he reported to us your longing, your mourning, your zeal for me, so that I rejoiced even more." So look at that report. He even talks about some of the report that he got. Now, drop down to verse 13. "For this reason we have been comforted. And besides our comfort, we rejoiced even more for the joy of Titus, because his spirit has been refreshed by you all. For if in anything I have boasted to him about you, I was not put to shame. But as we spoke all things to you in truth, so also our boasting before Titus proved to be the truth. His affection abounds all the more toward you, as he remembers the obedience of you all, how you received him with fear and trembling. I rejoice that in everything I have confidence in you." And so you could tell that Paul was a little worried what would have happened to Titus. How would the Corinthians treat him? What would his trip there be like? And when he finally met Titus, it was like the best news he could hear. They received Titus with love. They lifted up his spirits. They were obedient to whatever he was telling them. And so it lifted up Paul's spirits as well. So, in verse 5, he says, "We suffered." Now, what's this connected to? Remember he said, "We are filled with joy even in affliction." And so, Paul suffered in Macedonia. Now, this is not recorded. This trip to Macedonia, it's not recorded. The only way we know about it, really, is because of what's written here, and kind of by by way of what is written in the book of Acts. But in the book of Acts, it doesn't tell us what happened here in Macedonia. But remember, 2 Corinthians, we believe, is written here in Macedonia, while Paul is in Macedonia. Okay? So, he suffered in Macedonia. Now, in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, Macedonia was mentioned. So it's kind of a deja vu. Oh yeah, I remember. So in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 12 and 13, remember he says, "Now when I came to Troas for the gospel of Christ, and when a door was opened for me in the Lord, I had no rest for my spirit, not finding Titus my brother. But taking my leave of them, I went on to Macedonia." Do you remember this? Paul says, I was in Troas. Okay? Remember, Troas is on the Asia Minor side. Philippi, Macedonia, is on the Macedonian side. So he was in Troas, and he says, this big door for teaching. Many people wanted to learn and come to the gospel. It was there, but I left. Now, I don't think Paul just left. I'm sure he left them with some teachers. But he couldn't stay himself. And so there's this big door, and he leaves, and he goes to Macedonia. Why? Why would he leave that opportunity? Well, what's he saying? Titus! Apparently, they had made plans, and I guess he could figure out how long it would take to travel and all that. They made plans to meet in Troas. And so Paul was waiting and started teaching, and this big door opened up, but Titus hadn't arrived. And he waited, and still Titus hadn't arrived, and he was worried. I don't know why he just didn't call him or text him on his cell phone, but he was worried. And so he's trying to show his love for Titus, that even though it's all about the gospel, because he couldn't find Titus, he went on to Macedonia to see if something had happened. And when he was at Macedonia, he found him. And he was well. And he was safe. And so now comes the report. So Paul was comforted not only because he found Titus, but because of Titus' report. So let me ask you, what did Titus tell Paul about the Corinthians? What are some of the things specifically said here? Give it to me. Okay? Go ahead. Okay, their earnest desire, mine says their longing, right? Then the last one, the third one, the New American said, your zeal. Who was their zeal for? Yeah, for Paul. Oh man, Paul thought things were bad, but now he's got this light of hope. But notice the one in between, the longing and the zeal. He was comforted because he heard of their mourning. Well, that's kind of a mean thing to say, isn't it, Paul? You're happy because they're mourning? What does that mean? Well, Sunday morning we're going to talk about the mourning. It will be explained in these verses in between here. Okay? So, it's just one of those things, as you're kind of dissecting the text, like, why is he happy that they're mourning, right? You want to ask those questions. That just seems out of place, right? I understand the longing, that's a good thing. I understand the zeal, but why is he so excited or comforted by their mourning? And so there's three things he mentions that he rejoiced, and not only rejoiced, but he says, I rejoiced even more. And then we read verses 13 through 16, where the focus is not just on the report of what they felt for Paul, but verses 13 through 16, was the focus is on what that made Paul rejoice? How they did what? How they treated Titus. So the top verses are their feelings for Paul, and down in verses 13 and following, it's their feelings and how they receive Titus. Do you see that? He says, Titus's spirit, verse 13, has been refreshed by you all. Paul was excited because whatever he boasted about them, Titus saw that. He didn't say, well, I don't see what Paul's talking about. They're not like that. No, he says, Titus proved the truth of what I said to him. And so Paul was excited on all these different fronts about how they felt for him, how they were, how they received Titus. Now, the last thing as we close, and we'll start here Sunday, what is it that these false teachers have got their hands on and they're using to say Paul is a condemning man? Paul doesn't really love you. It's all about the money. You can't understand. What is it? And the answer to that is a letter. They got their hands on a letter. Remember, we always say something like, don't write anything down because once it's written down, you can't erase it. Right? Well, they got their hands on a letter. And we'll talk about that Sunday morning. All right, everyone, have a good week.